festivities. It was the dawn of a new century. 125 years after the country's founding, perhaps Americans were now finally sophisticated enough to be considered equal to Europeans. Princes would mingle with their daughters. Never mind that their American grandfathers had fought against princes and kings. Let bygones be bygones. Though some American families had amassed riches beyond riches at this point, there was still one thing money couldn't buy. A title. And for that, these eligible American bachelorettes were paired up with European noblemen, who found that U.S. dollars went a long way in restoring their dilapidated estates. Songs about these dollar princesses rang out through music halls declaring, "The almighty dollar will buy, you bet, a superior class of coronet. That's why I've come from over the way, from New York City of USA." Everything European had to be absolutely wonderful. The satirical magazine Puck found this kind of striving faintly ridiculous. They featured one cartoon of an absurd, unwieldy carriage justified by a man proudly exclaiming, "It's English, you know." The highest goal of many wealthy American families was to marry their daughters not merely into nobility, but into royalty. And who could possibly be a better matrimonial target than an actual prince? Said to be en route to Newport from Corsica, this was no dour English duke. Ladies did not want to end up in a humorless, perpetually damp castle like Consuelo Vanderbilt, who'd marry the Duke of Marlborough and claimed that she spent her days staring longingly at a frigid lake on her estate where a butler had committed suicide. This man might even have a castle in a sunny climate with a fun, suicide-free lake. The possibilities. A word of caution, though. According to Henry Harry Lair, a close friend of the hostess, the prince could be inclined to be wild. Furthermore, he could not have too much to drink because anything goes to his head, and then he is apt to behave rather badly. However, amid this corseted, constrained, and utterly prim and polite society, that too might have seemed alluring. When Newport inhabitants wondered if it might be one of the Del Dragos they knew from Rome, Harry Lair informed them, "They all belong to the same family, only the prince's is a distant branch. Perhaps an older, even more distinguished branch." And so, the lucky few invited to Mrs. Fish's dinner were positively aflutter. The beautiful women now clustered within the Ocean Drive mansion were understandably concerned whether their own manners would be up to the task of meeting such an established fellow. They discussed their curtsies. Unmarried women primped desperately, patting their faces with powder and pinching their subtly rouged cheeks. They were ready to fall in love with whoever arrived. They only hoped he would love them back. There was a palpable sense of excitement in the air, ladies already bobbing into curtsies, eyelashes fluttering down appealingly as the wealthy Chicagoan Joseph Leiter walked into the room with the prince in hand. No, literally in hand. For the illustrious Prince Del Drago was actually a monkey dressed in a tuxedo. When attendees recovered enough from their complete shock to look over at the hosts, they saw that Mamie Fish and Harry Lair were doubled over in hysterics. This joke had been devised beforehand on Fish's yacht while they were traveling into Newport with the little prince, Mamie's newest pet, affectionately named Jocko. No sooner had they docked than Mamie breezed into the finest tailor in Newport, demanding a suit of custom dinner clothes be made for Jocko. Naturally, the establishment refused. Never one to take no for an answer, Mamie promptly fixed the tailor with a frosty glaze and declared, "Name your price, but start sewing, quickly." The New York